everybody, and welcome back to the podcast that exists solely to remind you that this world is a beautiful, magical, mysterious place. And to that end, I have guests appear on the show who generously share their stories of magic and miracle. This episode's guest, Eric Robinson, has had quite a colorful career, and we talk about it a little bit later. But suffice it to say that among pastor, FBI agent, SWAT team member, as well as author, Eric has pretty much covered it all. But I'm going to let Eric introduce himself and then share his magic miracle stories. And with that, here's my conversation with Eric Robinson.
I walk over to the applicant coordinator and I said, "Hey, I'm thinking about those sit-ups and I think I miscounted by one." And she says, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, I mean, this kid gave an effort. We've had people like just walk away after they are disqualified and not even give an effort." I said, "He gave everything. So that means something." So I walk over to the kid and I said, "Hey, we're going to give you one more sit-up. I want you to remember this. I want you to value this. If you get in, I want you to remember that somebody stuck their neck out and gave you this chance." So I know the first thing that people go to is they start with what you do, defining themselves from work or past work. So obviously that does inform of who I am, of what I've been about, but consciously knowing that and trying to get away from it, when I was working with a photographer to shoot a cover, get some shots for my upcoming book, I said, "What I'm looking for is empathetic badass." So I'll just start with that. Like, I'm confident in my ability to take care of myself, to take charge, to lead, and to overcome if I need to. But also, I like that in my back pocket, such that through my years in law enforcement, I didn't feel that need to go in and try to show this guy that I'm the tough guy, I'm in charge. When I and a dozen of my friends break down a person's door, put them in handcuffs and say, "We're going to take you to jail," if I need to do something more than that to show that I'm in charge, that's kind of pathetic. So that's when I would come in then with that empathy, trying to find the humanity in people, which I found effective, of like breaking down barriers, which are going to be obvious. If you're arresting a criminal, there's going to be a barrier, you know, but the connections were made in now taking it back to a common level of, "We're going to have a conversation, that I'm going to help you through this difficult moment." So empathetic badass. How about that?
I accept those adjectives. I accept both of those adjectives. And I think they're really powerful because it demonstrates that you know there is more than one way of being in this world, and that you can, you know, they're both kind of superpowers, but unite them.
Yeah.
Even greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah. I mean, I could play bad cop whenever I needed to, and it's a lot more fun. Bad cop is great. That's a good time. Get that energy out. But it just was not, it wasn't necessary. And so many times the criminals would match what I or the other agents with me presented. So we come in, obviously we're taking charge, but being professional, being polite, like, "Oh, okay. So they're going to do the same and be respectful."
I like that. Let me ask you this question. So I obviously know a little bit about you because I read your bio. So I know a little bit about you, but so I know the pivoting you've done in your career. Okay. So when you were a kid, what did you dream of becoming? And are you surprised where you ended up?
Oh, the second question, completely. It's not something I expected. I wasn't looking at, I want to be a cop someday or in the military. My dad was in the military, but that was not a big part of what he talked about. So, you know, this wasn't massive in my home. I mean, growing up, I think I probably was thinking teacher. I went to college and began studying journalism. I enjoyed writing, and I got to now do that. Part of being the FBI, part of that is, you know, a lot of action, and more of it is writing reports. So I got to use that going in. So it, you know, always seemed like something in those lines of writing, speaking, instructing. And then in 2002 came that pivot from what I started with to now 24 years in the FBI.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was just interviewing someone and he said, you know, you have this idea for a path that you're going to take, what your life's going to look like. And then oftentimes life has other plans for you. And suddenly you discover you're going in a totally different direction. Has that ever happened to you in your life?
Yes. I out of college. So while I was in college, I studied religion. I went on a missions trip with a Christian group to the Middle East to work with Muslims. I came back and here's my senior year. I had a ring on my finger that I had purchased in Turkey as a promise to go back as a missionary. And I see four cute Christian girls sitting at a table in a frozen yogurt shop. And I sat down with them. I knew them. Sat down and I put the ring on the table and I said, who wants to marry me and go to Turkey? And this one curly-headed girl picked up the ring and put it on her finger. And she said, I will. And I go, in my mind, I'm thinking, not you, you have a boyfriend. I was like talking to one of the single ones. And then 2 years later, I put a better ring on her finger and proposed in a more direct way. So my wife and I had trained to be missionaries to Muslim countries. Things changed. We stayed stateside. And from college, I spent 12 years in Christian ministry until in the mid late 90s, planted a Baptist church in Western New York and really enjoyed being part of that ministry. As the senior pastor, I got to dictate how we're going to do church. We were meant to be a church of outreach. I took folks that were that core group and I said, listen, if we're going to make mistakes, we're going to err on the side of grace. Let God judge us for being too accepting. I'll own that. But we want people to be able to come in and feel completely accepted, not just in the old Christian way of like everyone's welcome. But I gave them a flinch test and I said, look, can you accept people who are wearing an Iron Maiden t-shirt, you know, when they come in, weird piercings, tattoos, homosexual, interracial, you smell alcohol in their breath. Can you look at them and there's nothing there other than so glad you're here? And we did great with that. I enjoyed that. We were successful, people's lives being changed. And then over time, I realized the stress of ministry is something I could not handle. And so for 2 years straight, every single day of my life, I had stress headaches that wouldn't go away. And then I came to a point where I realized I needed to make a choice because my body was telling me something. I was fighting against it. And what's my body going to do next? You know, saying, hey, Eric, I tried with the headaches. All right, now I'm going to give you a stroke. If you're not going to listen, I'm going to get your attention. And so I left the church. I preached my last sermon, Easter 2002. The next Sunday, I was in Quantico, Virginia, in the FBI training academy. And then the Sunday after that, I was preaching in the FBI academy because they didn't have a chaplain and they needed me to fill in. So they kind of eased me into it. That's my pivot.
That's a serious pivot. I was, and also very quick. It was quick. It happened over the course of a week. I do think it's so interesting because, you know, I have a master's of divinity and people have said to me, oh, why don't you, you know, why don't you work in a church or why don't you lead a church or why don't you? And I was like, are you crazy? I mean, when I was in seminary, the one thing they just hammered into us over and over was self-care. And they said, when you, when you're a leader, when you are in charge, like don't, you will be on call 24/7 because something is going to happen. Someone will need you. And not only are you in charge, but also paperwork, you know, everything else that comes with being the leader of a faith community. And they just said, we cannot emphasize self-care enough, literally enough. And I thought to myself, I know that I don't have the system that can handle being on call 24/7. So I just want to say kudos to you for recognizing that and taking steps.
Taking 2 years to finally get around to it. I lack that. And I was the senior pastor, so I didn't have outlets. And I know it was self-imposed, but I felt like I had to be perfect, had to be happy, had to have the right answers. And I, even though it's self-imposed, there's a bit of truth to it because I wasn't making it up whole cloth that people are looking for their pastor to not have problems. So here's me having to be Pastor Eric all of the time. And now that I'm retired from the FBI, people are like, oh, you want to go back into ministry? And I go, hey, look, man, that's like me thinking about an ex-girlfriend going, she was great. And I remember, oh no, she was crazy though too. Yeah. No, that's why we broke up. So I was much younger. I probably have much better skills to deal with that, but I'm not going to play with those explosives again.
Yeah, really. I mean, this is a question. Did you find being in the FBI easier because you had a team? It was like a team?
Team? Kirsten, if you come to me and you say, I've got depression because my husband's leaving me, my spouse is leaving me, that doesn't end after we talk. And so it just carries on. And then I'm worried about your problems. And that's not to mention the next guy who comes. So in the bureau, like I saw some horrible things, some terrible victims, but that wasn't my job to take care of them. And so it was much easier. Like I could care what happens, but even my getting involved with supporting them beyond arresting the perpetrators would be inappropriate. And so that created a boundary that I didn't even have to think about. It was a necessary boundary. And so those problems just didn't follow me. Whereas in ministry, it's you're in my church. It's not like, awesome, we got to where you're perfect and you have no problems. I can move on to talk to other people and not worry about you. That just doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, also, you know, when I was in seminary, I was taught by a lot of faith leaders in different classes and different subjects. And a lot of them were either current pastors or retired pastors. And I mean, I was like, you know, after the third or fourth person who's saying, please put yourself first because you're just, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be, it's going to get to you eventually that, yeah.
Well, I mean, that's like checking out somebody and all the past, you know, all their past girlfriends are saying, yeah, you know, he's a good guy, but you know, sometimes just gets a little angry. You're like, you hear that enough. You're like, oh, that's enough subtle flags that, people are trying to hide here. And it's, again, it's not to say that doing ministry is so bad. For some people, it can be breezier. Some people just have the tools. Maybe you would have had the tools if you got into it. Maybe you would have found like, oh no, this is just too much. But no matter what, people underestimate what it's like to deal with people, to, you know, not really, but in a sense, be in charge of their salvation and their welfare. Again, not fully, but having that as part of what is assigned to you, you know, and that's aside from trying to do right, trying to reach out to people, grow the church, worrying about finances, you know, writing the sermons. I loved writing the sermons. That was the easiest part. And then the rest was tough.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't even imagine. You know, you were in the FBI for quite a while. Can I ask you if, I mean, I don't know, were any parts of it, because you already alluded, and I also know that you use the word gritty for, you know, some aspects of your job. However, were there parts of it that were generative or positive or life-giving for you?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, starting with this and just setting it aside after I say it, there's a lot of thrills. And so being part of those, I mean, it's exciting to know you're going to go into a dangerous situation and then you come out of it. That's thrilling. Also, because I survived and I'm still here, there's something about doing a dangerous thing and learning from that of what you're capable of how to handle it. So it's interesting. I spent 15 of those years on the SWAT team, and having trained so much and knowing tactics so well, and then seeing the guys next to me being at least as confident as me, it brought me to a place where we're about to enter a house. We don't know if there's anyone hiding who might oppose us violently. And yet there's nothing at all buzzing in the back of my head that says, oh, Eric, this is crazy. You need to be scared. There's just no fear. And that's a remarkable place to get to, where all I had to do was focus on what's my task and do I have the tools necessary to carry it out? I mean, I don't say that boastfully, but if you would have gone back and talked to Pastor Eric and say, hey, at some point you're going to do dangerous things and there just won't be fear, that's something that the FBI built into me, allowing me those experiences to get there. And then finally, I would have discussions with my dad, who's also a believer, and I'd say, hey, we should be doing this in the church and Christians should be doing this. And my dad would say, hey, Eric, you're kind of sheltered. You know, you're in a homogeneous group of people who just want to hear what you have to say. There's a lot out in the world that's more than just church. And again, respectfully, because he believed in Christ, or does still. And I get into the FBI and I'm like, damn, the old man was right. Like, there's so much beyond. And so talking to gang members in Chicago and understanding that you don't just say Chicago gang members, man, they're violent. They are. Here's a kid who needs affiliation, as all humans want. Here's someone who has limited options in life. Like, he didn't have what I have. Maybe less education, less opportunity from family support, income, you know, benefits. Here's all these things. And so it does not excuse drug sales, prostitution, violence, but it makes it so much more understandable that, oh, okay, he's not just a violent gang member. It's this. And I try to encapsulate like what I would never have expected when I was working crimes against children in Toledo, Ohio. And at the time, our mandate was to find, sex traffickers, but in that rescuing some of the underage girls that they're trafficking. So my partner, Laura, and I are working with this 15-year-old girl who had been prostituting, and I'm driving her around, trying to convince her to show us where she had been tricking and give us information. And it's an uphill battle trying to build rapport. And she says, I could use a cigarette. And so I pull into a parking lot with me and my partner and her. And I go, well, I don't have cigarettes, but I do have cigars. And so as my partners give me the side eye, I'm like, Laura, she's doing worse things in life than smoking a cigar. Here's me sharing a cigar with a 15-year-old prostitute, and I'm winning her over so that she can help herself and help us take these terrible people off the street. So to your question, it broadened my mind so much to see who people are.
Gosh, I can't even imagine. That's utterly astonishing. And I'm sure you didn't know what each day was going to bring you, which, you know.
When I work crimes against children, my wife, you know, well-meaning, would say, oh, hey, what are you doing? What's going on for you today? And I go, look, I know what I have planned. Who knows what's going to happen? Some kid's going to run away and we're going to be out all night. So stop asking me what I'm doing at work. I don't know.
I have to say that I kind of love your wife, because also just how audacious and brave you were to walk over to those girls at the frozen yogurt shop and put that ring down and say, I mean, that is like the best meet cute story I've ever heard. Uh-oh. And then her response, also brave and audacious, to like put it on her finger. She has a boyfriend, but she does it. And then the rest is history, as they say.
Oh, I was so heartbroken. I had graduated. She was still in. She's a couple of years younger. And she's like, she wrote me a letter, and I'd pen palled with her a little bit. She said, oh, Doug and I broke up. I'm like, God, that's so sad. I'm gonna write you some more often. But what was great with my wife is we were in ministry together. Whenever I was, she went to grad school just as I did to be a missionary. So she was very supportive. She was fully a part of what we're doing. Then I go off to the FBI. Well, now not only is that me doing stuff on my own, but there's a decent number of things I can't share with her. And when we started in Chicago, she would be texting me like, hey, let me know when you're safe. And, you know, is everything okay? And that's how it started. By the time I'm in 20 years, I'm on SWAT. I do all this stuff and I say, hey, honey, just so you know, we've got an operation, SWAT op on Tuesday. And she goes, okay, I'll put it in the calendar. And I go, oh, guy's kind of dangerous. And she says, uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he told an informant he wouldn't be taken alive. And she just goes, I said I'd put it in the calendar. What do you want me to do? And so she so completely changes to, look, you go out, you come home. Like, I'm like, hey, put a little bit. You know, you have to be worried for me, but, you know, put a little emphasis on this. Like, some of these are dangerous.
Okay. What I adore about that is that, you know, in my calendar, it says haircut. And,
right.
You know, oh, maybe donate something to Goodwill. And
yeah, dog to the vet.
Yeah, dog to the vet. And then here it's like SWAT operation. And that's utterly amazing. Let me ask you the second question, which is silly because I've asked you so many already. But did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like? And then I know a little bit about your faith journey afterwards, but did that evolve at all over time?
Yeah, it really did. The Robinsons just went to church. I grew up Lutheran. I ended up pastoring Baptist, which is, in case you don't know, your listeners don't know, shorthand is Lutherans say if God didn't want us to do it, he would have told us in the Bible not to do it. So they're very, very permissive. And the Baptists say if God said it was okay to do, he would have told us it's okay to do in the Bible. So very strict. I found the Baptist theology closer to what I believed, the lifestyle more like with the Lutherans. So I grew up, we went to church every Sunday. It wasn't demanding. It's just Robinsons go to church, and Dad did a great job. My mom was really the spiritual leader of the household, and I loved her for that. However, my dad would read a little daily devotion for us 3 minutes in the morning before he left for work. And that just showed a really, as far as he could, some leadership in that. And I always appreciated it. So that was modeled well. When I went to college, now my faith became a little more personal. I started not just knowing the Bible from hearing about it, but now from studying it for myself, and then moving into, hey, I think this is something that I should do for life. I didn't feel like it was a calling. I'm very practical. I just felt like, okay, I know the Bible. I know this is important. I enjoy talking to people. You know, all of these together equal, this is a good route. So no voice in my ear, but a meaningful career to choose.
Very cool. How did your, were your parents surprised by that choice?
No. And they were supportive. So on my dad's side, my great grandfather on my dad's side was a Lutheran minister in South Dakota. He preached to a German congregation in the early 1900s, like 1920s. Unfortunately, we were at war with Germany at the time. And so my predecessors visited him and said, hey, you can't preach in German. We don't know if you're spreading propaganda. And my great grandfather said, what am I supposed to do? They only know German. So he spent a number of months in an internment camp for that. So we've got it in the family, at least.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. I'm sorry to hear that. I mean, what a time to be alive and balance security for the nation with someone who's just trying to be present to their congregation so that they can actually understand what's being said. I mean, that just seems really unfair to me.
No, I'm not going to argue.
But that's just me. That's just me. And gosh. Okay. So it's a legacy. It's in your family. It's something that was not surprising for your parents. And also your parents sound really supportive anyway.
Oh yeah.
I feel you know, you also are, I mean, I'm just going to put this out there, highly intelligent. So I feel like there was a level of trust. They trusted you to make the right decisions. Were they surprised when you joined the FBI?
I'm not even going to address that. Okay. I'll just go to, my dad will wear FBI gear when he goes to the grocery store so that the cashier like, oh, that's a cool hat. And he goes, yeah. My son's in the FBI, just so he can start talking about it. So they were very, I don't know if they expected it. I'm very stubborn and determined. And so I think they looked at it as, yep, Eric did a fine job here. And if he's going to take this on, he'll probably make it. My background was, again, to be a missionary to Muslim countries. And so I think that that had something to do with why the FBI goes, okay, let's take a chance on this kid. And of course, just as the government operates, that knowledge of Islam as international terrorism was coming forward, they put me on a drug squad. So I didn't work counterterrorism for like 15 years. God.
Forgive me for my ignorance, but do you get to choose where you get placed in the FBI?
Oh, that's not ignorant. People wouldn't know that. That's a good question. It has changed since I got in and now out. When I came in, you ranked the 56 field offices, and you're almost certainly not going to get your home office. So I processed out of Buffalo. If I put Buffalo 1, 2, whatever, I wasn't going to go there. Now, and then they just send you wherever. So you could, all of a sudden, New York division is way down on bodies. So you could have 12 people from your class going to New York. Now it's more, very reasonable. There are people who in Canton, Ohio, I had a buddy who was a task force officer, became an agent, went right back to the squad that he was a task force officer on, supporting the FBI as an agent. So much better where you can return. So it's the idea of like, you're trying to get certain places, and then you will go where the Bureau says we've got needs.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, a level of flexibility is needed.
Got to be wide open. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, you're talking about your time in the FBI. Do you have the choice to stay in one place or do they sometimes move you?
Well, yes. And also yes. So if, for example, you go to New York City and you want to stay there, you're going to stay there. You can always stay where you are. You may be moved from squads. I worked just about every violation the Bureau handles, and a lot of that was just circumstance. I was on a drug squad for 5 years in Chicago. We had two drug squads. Well, they dissolved mine. I think it's because we had solved the drug problem, and it was all maintenance from there. So, but you know, so I would have worked that, but now they put me to a different squad. I transfer to another squad after that. Then I transfer to Toledo, worked one violation for a while. Then task force leader for the crimes against children takes a spot in DC. I'm asked if I can fill in for a couple of years. I do. Now I'm back to a new squad. So there's circumstances. And it's also nice that if you work dope for like 10 years and you go, yeah, I'm kind of tired of this. Now I'm going to go to healthcare fraud or, you know, something that's white collar, a little more banker's hours.
Okay. Okay. Got it. Thank you. Thank you for answering all my questions. I appreciate
all of them.
I'd love to ask you the main question, which is, which I said is more of a statement or a demand. So love for you to, you know, share one story, two stories where you feel like you witnessed or experienced something magical, miraculous, or mysterious.
So pushy. Oh, man. So as I said, I'm very practical, but there's a few things that have happened during my time that I just are kind of fun for me as coincidences. I spent 15 years as a SWAT operator. The best people I've met in my life are in the FBI. The best people in the FBI are on SWAT. Because when you go into life-threatening situations with other men and one woman, it binds you together. Like, you got through this and you've spent all that time training. So one day I'm talking to my buddy Travis. We finished an operation. It's getting near Easter. I say, hey, Travi, what are you guys going to do for Easter? And he says, oh, we're going to go back to my in-laws, visit my in-laws in Jamestown, New York. And I go, well, that's where I pastored and I know most of the people there. What's their last name? And he tells me their last name. And I go, Travis, did like 6 or 7 years ago, you talked to an FBI agent on the phone asking about being in the FBI? And right there, this guy who I'd been serving next to on the SWAT team for a few years, I find out my buddy, a former pastor, calls me one day years prior and says, hey, my future son-in-law is thinking about getting in the FBI. He's in the military. Would you mind if he talks to you? And I said, sure thing. I talked to this kid for an hour. Great. Sounds wonderful. I tell him this is the way to go. And then that's it. Years later, I don't even realize I'm serving next to him, you know, risking lives next to each other. It's just so awesome and unexpected. It's like going to a junior high and like giving a presentation. And then someday one of those kids comes back and says, hey, you left such an impression on me. Here I am. So that one was pretty cool.
I love that. Really,
yeah. That was so meaningful to me. Related to that, but a little bit different. I was a fit instructor in the Bureau, which nobody cares about, but part of what we get to do is we test the applicants. So you have to pass a fitness test at Quantico. And so we test you in the field to see if you are ready. You have to score a certain number of points. So I'd done so many people that I've got my little spiel, my script of what I do. And as we get to the push-up part, I show protocol for push-ups and I say, listen, if you guys are in the military, I see a lot of this, you know, guys start just going, pumping them and they're not locking out and coming fully down. This is what protocol is. So if you're in the military, please take your time fully up and down. And I go through that. And yeah, so we pass these guys through. One of those guys comes back. He's later my team leader on SWAT. And he tells me this story. He goes, yeah, actually, I applied when I was in Cleveland. And this one asshole fit instructor is like, and you guys in the military, you guys all suck. You have no idea how to do push-ups. And he was talking it up like as a joke. He's like, and I swore that day, I'm going to get into the FBI. I'm going to get back to Cleveland. And I'm going to be that guy's team leader. and we were great friends. So, but just a fun coincidence of, yeah, I mean, for me, it's heartwarming. I got to be an influence. And then these guys got to be just wonderful agents, too, that I respected so much. So I was very glad for those circumstances.
Those are really fun stories of kind of connection and unexpected synchronicity. You know, I think, like for your first example, your first story, you're having this conversation with this young man. And I don't think at the time for any of us, we sometimes realize the power of what we're saying and how it can change someone's life. And also, you know, maybe shoot them off in a direction that they didn't expect, you know, that changes everything. So, I mean, I'm sure you thought to yourself, oh, my gosh, that's wild. That's wild. But like, good.
Yeah. I was just helping a buddy. Hey, you know, my son-in-law, future son-in-law is thinking about this. Like, yeah, I definitely give somebody perspective. He's connecting this guy to someone that he knows this might help. And yeah, sure. I mean, it's like carrying groceries for somebody. Yeah, no problem. And I made such a right decision on that because Travis is such a great human being. Like, he's the kind of person that I tried to be in the Bureau, and I see him as like, yeah, good hearted, wanting to help, good spirit. Flip side of that story. So I'm a fit instructor. I'm not trying to emphasize that so you can see how well built I am. I'm in Chicago, and we've got a bunch of people doing the fit test, and I see this, you know, young kid coming in. He's lean, and we start out, and the first event is sit-ups. So what we do is you count the total number of sit-ups, and then I'm pretty flexible with this too. If you're breaking protocol, you know, you're not coming down all the way, now we take away how many bad sit-ups. So I tell the kid, hey, you did this many minus this, not even thinking, I dropped him one under qualifying. So the first event, he's already disqualified. We go on to the other events. He does great. Mile and a half run. He scores top score possible in that, like giving his full effort, even though he'd already been disqualified. I walk over to the applicant coordinator and I said, hey, I'm thinking about those sit-ups and I think I miscounted by one. And she says, are you sure? I said, yeah. I mean, this kid gave an effort. We've had people like just walk away after they are disqualified and not even give an effort. I said, he gave everything. So that means something. So I walk over to the kid and I said, hey, we're going to give you one more sit-up. I want you to remember this. I want you to value this. If you get in, I want you to remember that somebody stuck their neck out and gave you this chance. And then I followed up later with the applicant coordinator to see how the kid was doing. And she said, oh, he bombed the polygraph. Like, he admitted to so many felonies that he didn't put on his record. I'm like, oh my gosh, I almost ran a criminal into the FBI. I was trying to be a good guy.
Say, is it the the good intention was there on your part?
Well, that's why we have multiple levels of scrutiny.
Wise yeah. Decision.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing both of those stories. I was also just reflecting on your second story, how it's so good to have a sense of humor, I think. FBI in general, like, it just seems like it would be something that could potentially really help with the stress or the intensity.
Well, I agree. And what's funny is I saw this meme of, I forget how it went, but it's, you know, whether military or law enforcement, the idea is like, I tell you this story that I think is hilarious, and you reply with, I'm sorry you had to go through that. I'm like, no, it's funny, you know? And you're like, you almost got killed. Like, yeah, but I didn't. And that's part of how it's dealt with. Like, seriously, we're telling stories about, you know, one story, like I'm straight up honest, guys laugh about this. We had a SWAT operation and one of our guys goes up to the third deck, pitch black, can't see, steps on the subject who's hiding underneath clothes on the floor, laying on his stomach, hand on a loaded shotgun, and, you know, scared him, of course. Multiple people could have been killed, but they weren't. So it's hilarious, you know, and we tell that story like it's funny because no one got hurt. And death, you know, what do we say to death? Not today.
I'd like to thank Eric for coming onto the show and being so funny and so kind, and actually maybe having the best sense of humor that I've experienced in a really long time. I'm also grateful that he shared his journey, which really is rather singular. I mean, you don't really meet many pastors that then serve in the FBI. So I'm grateful that he's out there sharing his story and letting us know just what it looks like to have a career with lots of different paths. To do a deeper dive on Eric, follow those links in the episode show notes. There's all sorts of great stuff, including links to his book. And to that point, don't miss the Easter egg I've included at the end of this outro. I want to thank everyone who listens, and especially those people who have given me ratings or reviews. Those ratings and reviews mean ever so much. You'll really never know. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Eric. Like many of the guests on this show who have had really dynamic and interesting lives, Eric has not kind of just settled for one direction. I mean, he's been up for the adventure, and, you know, I always say, listen, listeners, be up for the adventure, and Eric is such a prime example of that. He's someone who steps into the magical path and decides to walk it no matter where it takes him. And because of that, he's done so much good for so many. So be like Eric and find your path. Find your path and then have the bravery to walk it. We need more of you out there, just like Eric, walking your paths with honesty, integrity, and with a deep sense of adventure. And you know what I'm going to say? I'm going to say, if you do that, you know, can you even believe how much magic and beauty you're going to bring to the world? All right, you'll be hearing from me with the very next episode of the podcast, but be sure not to miss the Easter egg, which starts right about now. I'd love to talk about your book.
Oh, okay.
Can you share a little bit about that? Maybe the genesis, how did you come about, you know, considering, because writing a book is no joke. It's so much work. It is so much work. So maybe the genesis, how you decided that you wanted to, and then what it's about and what you hope it conveys to people.
I'm going to give you another reason to like my wife, I guess. She and her company, Weaving Influence, have spent 14 years promoting, marketing authors. So as I am nearing the end of my career, I say to her, what should I do? And she says, well, you can start with writing a book. And I go, yeah, you know, I've always wanted to. I enjoy writing, but I didn't write things down. And I wanted to when I got in, but I didn't. And then I felt it was too late. And she says, well, just try, you know, see what comes out of it. So I sit down at the computer and I'm going to try to map out, you know, the skeleton of it. And then I'll add to it later. It'll be this then that. And I think, well, let me just write the first chapter. And then it goes. And it's story after story. And it's these cases that I got to be a part of, interactions I had. It is the story of what happens if you take a Baptist pastor who's never handled a gun and you stick him in the FBI. And unlike some FBI stories that I've read, which are amazing and inspiring, many of them I find to be like fabulous. I think in my book, you can read it and go, oh, that was awesome. And also, I think I could do that. Because I was nothing special. I just got in and I got to be what the FBI allowed me to be and allowed my strengths to show through in. And because of that, here's just a guy who got to be part of really amazing investigations. And also, I tell a good story. So, you know, the investigation may not have been that great, but I'm gonna bring out all the high points to it. But what's remarkable is I can get on the phone right now. I can call anybody I know in the FBI and I can put them on speaker and I say, hey, just tell me a story. And they'll have one that'll just knock your pants off. You go like, oh, man, that's crazy. And I realized that having gone through of like there's so many things that I got to witness, participate in or initiate that people would probably want to hear about. So I write about that. And there's that thread throughout of this was the pastor doing this. What I learned in ministry, I got to bring out in my work in the FBI.
And I love the title. How did you come up with that?
So we had a working title that is one that I always played with because it was just a little kind of joke phrase I used when I was in. And the working title was Preacher to Breacher. So that's a really good one. I like that. But then as my wife, this is what she does for work, for a living, sent out a title survey and she says, okay, let's put some down that we like. I tried to think of what's a good one word title? Like what can encapsulate this? And it really came to me just sitting and trying to brainstorm. Yeah, I mean, I was a reverend, but boy, this stuff we just rolled around in, the things we see, the disgusting, the inhumane, that was irreverent. That really works well together. And what was awesome is then working with the team of doing that title of like, yeah, so here's the reverend, but you know, let's put the IR offset like that. Felt good.
Oh my gosh, it's a completely captivating title and such a great play on words. You know, it's, I mean, I don't know. I'm captivated. I love it. And I think because I love words and I just thought to myself, oh my God, who's the brilliant genius who came up with this? It's brilliant.
Ah, well, and then my wife's company, Weaving Influence, when she started that in 2012, she says, hey, I need the name of a company. And I go, how about Weaving Influence? And it fits so well. And then one time she had a client, we're traveling, she's on the phone and her client's saying, hey, I need a website that, you know, talks about, you know, doing things professionally and sharp. And if I can try to include my name, and his name was Mark, and I go, how about Mark of Excellence? And he goes, nah, because it's too perfect. Come on.
It is too perfect.
It's too perfect. I mean, it was almost one like, I'm afraid to say this because you already thought of this.
It's too perfect.